From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
At a wildflower talk I attended last spring, a lot of the audience questions after the expert finished her slides were ones like this. Is such and such a trillium native here? Or have you ever seen, insert name of a particular fern, growing in the wild in this area? We were all curious about the hyper-local version of what plants really are our natives. Yes, we know the labels on various commercial nursery plants like a coneflower or lupin or coreopsis may say, quote, native, but keen gardeners probably have figured out that that's often used quite generically in marketing, perhaps implying U.S. native or maybe regional native at best. As I add more natives consciously to my garden, I wanted to learn how to get a bit more precise than that. So who better to invite to visit with us today than Elizabeth Farnsworth, Senior Research Ecologist for the New England Wildflower Society. No matter where you live, Elizabeth and I want to help you map out a strategy for learning more about your native flora and about what native means at the moment, anyhow, and why it matters. So welcome back, Elizabeth, to help me with this puzzle, this mission I'm on. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Good. You've worked at the society since 1999, I think. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Let's not do the math. So.
Okay. Sorry about that. I'm sorry. And you've been working with native plants probably longer than that, to save rare plants, to conduct research on plant ecology and evolution, even responses to climate change. In your time in the field, I expect the word native has evolved in its definition, hasn't it?
Yes, it definitely has. You know, it has long, as a definition, puzzled scientists. We've been poring over this definition probably for 200 years or more. There's a very, very rich scholarship that goes back quite a long way in terms of trying to identify what would be considered a native species versus one that's introduced.
Mm.
And I think over time, we've made some strides in terms of developing something of a coherent definition, and it is increasingly based on the science, on the genetics, on understanding how long plants have been in a place for a period of time, and lots of other evidence. It's still continues to be a thorny issue, of course, because plants are constantly moving around. They do not respect political boundaries, and we're trying to train them that way, but they simply don't. They
mm-hmm.
move around by virtue of both humans moving them around, but also by natural processes, their own ability to disperse and establish in new places. So we're constantly sort of grappling with this. This is not a static definition, because
okay.
species themselves are not static.
So we should probably, you sort of just hinted at it, there's kind of some of our, quote, wildflowers, speaking of a generic word, you know, maybe naturalized plants, maybe plants that were brought over hundreds of years ago by settlers,
mm-hmm.
and they look like they've been here forever, and they're super familiar throughout our whole lifetimes and long before, but they're not technically native. So those are those naturalized plants.
Right. So they're plants that have basically escaped from cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
We brought them over, or, you know, potentially First Nations people were bringing them from place to place for their medicinal value, their food value, their wildlife value, et cetera. So humans have been moving plants around for a very, very long time.
Okay. So before we kind of figure out what exactly is a native, so besides satisfying my insatiable curiosity, why does it matter to know what the specific natives to a particular area are? What would be some of the reasons besides curiosity that, you know, it would be good to know?
Well, a lot of native plants have established themselves, established ecological relationships with other organisms, such as their pollinators, the birds and other animals that feed upon them. They provide foundational sort of ecosystem services in terms of flood control and erosion protection and lots of the other services that benefit us as well as other organisms. So, and some of these native species are what we consider to be foundation species. These are species such as hemlocks and mangroves, for example, that literally form the basis of whole ecosystems, of the habitats on which other organisms depend. So native species, do provide these essential services. They are an integral part. They've evolved here for a very long time and form part of a very diverse network of organisms. From the perspective of gardeners, I think it's also important to reframe the conversation in some ways and not get entangled in the weeds, so to speak, of native definitions, although we can certainly return to what scientists refer to as native. It's important to sort of understand the plants of the relatively natural areas around you, to observe them over time and to notice those interactions that they have with other organisms.
So is that sort of a habitat style of thinking then? That I'm thinking, like you said, there's these foundation species and then there's the community around them kind of, and is that how I'm thinking?
Right. Okay. And so, scientists and botanists, natural historians have developed definitions of what we call natural community types. These are types of habitats in which we can actually pretty reliably predict what will be the dominant plant species present because they have adapted to these habitats.
Mm.
Consider a salt marsh. Right. Salt marshes, go all up and down the east and west coasts of the United States. And we can pretty much predict, wow, I'm standing in salt marsh because there are these cordgrasses and other species that I have been recorded from these areas reliably for many, many years. We have a very rich history of botanical collection. We understand what species are likely to occur in those habitats, and we'll define them.
Okay.
And so if we find a species from a particular habitat type that we know is likely to occur there in a completely different habitat, so, think of finding, say, a pitcher plant, one of our carnivorous plants that we know only typically grows in nutrient-poor bogs.
Mm-hmm.
If we find that growing in a puddle in New York City, chances are it's probably not native there. So.
Okay. Okay, so that's how I can tell.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's
good. I'm glad I know that. Well, and again, the extremes can be from the nursery tag that I mentioned in the introduction, where it says they have some little icon or it says native or whatever. But, that could mean it's an American native. It can mean it's a native to the prairie or whatever, not
right.
to where I garden or where someone else gardens. And then there's the other extreme where in horticulture where, some of the wholesalers who get custom orders to propagate something for a landscape designer may order, 500 of something, but he wants the local ecotype. He wants the, I think that's what you call it, but the he wants the genetics to be not just the, fill in the blank, whatever it is. He wants the local genetics. He wants it propagated from the exact genetics. So it goes from like loosey-goosey to like, wow, down to the chromosomal whatever level, right?
Right. And that's something that we pay attention to ourselves at New England Wildflower Society and our partners working with programs such as the Seeds of Success program, where we are trying to restore habitats, for example, that were destroyed by Hurricane Sandy. And so when we collect seed to restore those habitats, propagate those plants, we want to collect seed from the areas close to where those areas are that we seek to restore. And the assumption there is that, in fact, those plants are probably reasonably well adapted to the areas in which they were formerly growing. It doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to introduce a particular species from Maine to Maryland, in order to reforest areas or to revegetate areas, because we can pretty well document that, you know, species from very different latitudes are probably not going to perform as well in much different latitudes.
Right. So let's get sleuthing then. Sort of let's talk about some sort of tools and tactics. And, you know, I think I mentioned to you when we've corresponded before this, you know, I'm a birder and I'm used to looking at like range maps for a species. You know, sometimes I'll see a bird and I don't know what it is and I think, could that be such and such? And one thing I always do is I look at the map.
Right.
And, you know, is it something that might pass here at migration time or be here in breeding season, whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And so with plants recently, as my interest in insect interactions and with plants has grown keener the last few years especially, I sort of started trying to do the same thing with plants and looking for, like, is there a set of maps? And so I found lots of different things that I've been using, but I'm wondering where you'd send me, and, you know, again, not just living in the Northeast, but where's the hunt begin?
There are a number of resources, and I've actually researched those since we corresponded before, going nationwide and also into Canada and beyond. I think botanists have been trying to create databases which help people understand the regional, national, and even continental distributions of these plants. And so, of course, I'm going to mention first.
Go botany, baby.
From New England Wildflower Society. And we have done an extensive amount of research to understand which plants are native to particular counties, particular states within the region. And this is based on a whole bunch of different lines of evidence, and I can go into those in a bit. So Go Botany is a great go-to for anyone in the six New England states. There is also Cal Flora. So for any of your listeners who are listening from California, I'm going for the areas of the country that have, you know, some of the most diverse plants on the planet. So Cal Flora is also a great repository of maps and information on what they consider the plants are that are native and possibly more important, potentially invasive in particular areas of the state. There's also nationally the Native Plant Information Network.
Oh.
This is based out of the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay.
In Texas. And you can get an alphabetized list of all of the plants. They have information on more than 8,500 species of plants nationwide on which they have data. And these are primarily native plants, but you can narrow down your search to a particular area. So if you are in, say, Illinois, you can search on what are the native plants that have been recorded in this database for Illinois. There are also state-level atlases, which are incredibly useful because generally botanists have been on the ground dedicated searching for and documenting plant populations. An example of this is in your very own state, the New York Flora Atlas. So
yes.
You can search for a list of plants that have been recorded for a particular New York county, and you can restrict that list then to list what are considered the native plants or, conversely, the non-native plants for that county.
Right, because when a flora, when a sort of survey of what's, like you say, botanists on the ground, seeing what's around, they're counting all that, they're looking to see the diversity, not just the one or the other. And then so you can, you know, you can then sort and say,
exactly.
I just want to see the natives.
And these are the dedicated experts who are really, you know, want to understand, you know, what's present, native.
Present,
native,
right. And what's native and right.
On the landscape.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, if any of your listeners are from Canada, there is the VASCAN, V-A-S-C-A-N, searchable online atlas of the vascular plants of Canada. It shows you a map along with the native or non-native status of plants, you know, at the provincial level.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you actually to create a province-based checklist. There's also the Biota of North America program, which again is another North American program that has mapped species. You can map them actually to county for each state, so you can search on a particular species and understand what its distribution is, native and non-native, and they are beginning to develop tools that allow you to create a checklist for your own county pretty much anywhere where
now,
you are.
Is that the one that you refer to in the Go Botany from New England Wildflower?
Yes, so yes. We share data. So the Biota of North America program, BONAP, did share data with us on regional distributions of plant species. And we have updated those data for New England based on the Flora Novae Anglii and all of the different floras that have been created for the six New England states. So what's represented on Go Botany, we are very grateful to BONAP for providing us with the baseline data, and we've tweaked those and updated them to reflect county status.
So there's lots, and I was recently turned on to that plant atlas, the New York Plant Atlas one by a botanist friend, and it's great. It's so great, and it's wonderful when I then compare, and just for those listeners who forget, I'm in the Northeast also, for those, I often compare then to the BONAP maps, and I've been sometimes when I see a plant and I think I know what genus it's in, I think it's a whatever, but I'm not sure which one. On the BONAP, you can just go by genus and you can see all the species within, you know, where what their range is, you know, sort of all together, like miniature maps gridded out, and you know, get a sense, hey, look, it's definitely not those three because those are only in the West or whatever.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's, and again, I don't have your expertise, so I'm doing this in a lot more of an amateurish way, but the maps are so, we all know about maps, and they're so visual, and you know what I mean? It's not a lot of Latin words. It's like, oh, yes, it could be these five, you know?
And it's so wonderful to have all of these different kinds of web tools, right?
Yes.
And what you want to actually be able to do is to visit a number of different sites. So, you know, NatureServe Explorer is yet another site, or the USDA Plants Database. You know, there may be a little bit of disagreement, you know, among these sites. So what you want to do is to kind of cross-reference. In the end, you know, your local floras are going to be some of your most current sources of information. So let's not just stay online, but to remember that hard copy books, field guides, are also being produced that at least for this year and the next several years will represent, you know, some of the most up-to-date information that you can get, and you can carry those right into the field with you. So there are also actually websites. I found one for the Rocky Mountain a website that gives you a whole list of field guides that are relevant to the Intermountain West.
So with the bird, going back to my bird analogy, because everything I feel like I go on an adventure, one of my first nature adventures was learning about birds. So I always try to use the skills that I've gleaned from that experience. And so one of the things is that sometimes the local bird club, if you have a really good bird club in your area, they have a list, a checklist on their website of local species. And what thinking is, Margaret thinks, aha, maybe the local preserve or the local wildflower society or the county, whatever, you know, some nonprofit might also have such a list. Would that would be another thing to, I mean, obviously you are one of the premier, the New England Wildflower Society, place that has those types of resources.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are, you know, organizations such as, for example, the New England Botanical Club, you know, whose members go out and do field forays and field trips to various localities all over New England. And they will come up with a plant list from a particular field trip and post that right on their website. So that if you go out to the same or a similar type of site, you might keep an eye out for some of those interesting plants that they saw.
In your work, do you still have field guides in your life, Elizabeth Farnsworth? Do you still have old stuff? Because I'm a field guide freak. I have cupboards full of them. I love field guides. But You use them?
Absolutely. There are, in fact, I have whole bookshelves full of field guides that I go to. Most recently, I've been called upon to go to a number of insect field guides.
Me too, yeah.
Working at Nasami Farm, which is our native plant nursery in Whately, Massachusetts, we see all sorts of crazy caterpillars out there. And having published a book on the ants of New England, my own field guide, co-authored, to the ants of New England, I am constantly called upon by people from near and far to say, okay, here's a photograph. What's this crazy insect? And of course, so I will go to David Wagner's amazing field guide to the caterpillars.
The
you know, he's an amazing professor at University of Connecticut. And of course, I have his encyclopedic field guide right there on my shelf. And, you know, sometimes that can be so much more efficient to leaf through an actual book. I'm going to sound like a Luddite here. Than trying to, you know, tap into a website where you're trying to narrow things down.
It's I'm crazy for the Dave Wagner book. I guess the Western volume is coming someday, too.
Is.
He's
yeah.
working on that. And Arthur Evans' Beetle, his book of beetles. And I have, you know, the Peterson Guide to Moths from Seabrook Leckie and whatever. And, you know, I mean, the butterflies and the this and that. Wow.
Yes.
You know, and I just, as you said, just paging through. Sometimes at outdoor stores, maybe where you would get camping gear or even fitness clothes, whatever, sometimes they'll have local little guidebooks, little field guides to your local area. And sometimes they're cute and they're not fancy, but they're so good. They're so good to have.
They are. You know, things like the Fern Finder, for example, which is a tiny little credit card-sized flip book that enables you to identify, you know, most of the important true ferns in the Northeast. I mean, it just doesn't get better than that. How much more economical than, you know, it's a quarter the size of your cell phone, even. You can just put that into your backpack and go on your merry way.
The Fern Finder.
Yeah.
So we have, a couple of 2-3 minutes left, and I just am curious, what are you up to? What have you been up to this summer? What have you been discovering or rediscovering, or what have you been working on?
So I have become our rare plant seed curator at the Nasami Farm. We have launched, been the region's major repository of seeds for both rare and some common plants. I mentioned earlier our Seeds of Success program with respect to provenance. But we have hundreds of volunteers out on the New England landscape collecting seeds of rare plant species for our seed bank. And literally, I have processed over 2.3 million seeds coming in as collections over the last several years. And we already have more than 70 collections coming in from volunteers this summer, this field season. So I've been working with a fabulous bunch of dedicated volunteers to clean the seeds, to count them, to make sure they're in good shape before we package them up for permanent storage at our seed vault. And New England Wildflower Society is involved, or is spearheading, actually, a major effort to become the region's premier seed bank. We have a matching grant from the Iceland Foundation for $500,000 and to build a whole new seed bank facility at Garden in the Woods.
Wow.
So we've been really ramping up our seed collections. This is one bet hedging strategy against climate change.
Yes.
One of the many pronged ways in which we're conserving plants. It's been a fabulous project, and it's fascinating for me as a scientist to actually see the seeds of all these rare plants with which I'm very familiar with on the landscape, but to actually see their incredible seeds.
Very exciting. And maybe you can make some changes in some of those maps someday with some of those seeds.
Absolutely.
Where things are fading away, maybe they'll get a little reinvigoration with some of those seeds.
And we've been actually involved in a project at Cadillac Mountain, for example, at Acadia National Park in Maine to revegetate that denuded summit, with some seeds of plants that we collected from there. We grew them up, and we've replanted them out this summer in hopes of revegetating that area.
Well, thank you so much as ever. I just feel like you've now gone, you've got me, I'm going to really go down the rabbit hole.
Always happy to help.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. Elizabeth Great. Farnsworth of New England Wildflower Society. I hope I'll speak to you again soon.
I hope so, too.
Okay.
Take care.
And I hope I'll speak to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. Subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening and garden sleuthing in the meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.